Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tech Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff to German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I am your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, or Iconic, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you very much. We certainly do appreciate your amazing support. Hey, the new book is out, Hypocrisy. You can get the digital format of it in PDF and EPUB from me if you want to. If you want to bypass the booksellers, you can go to my website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. If you donate $10 via PayPal, I'll send you the new book. If you donate $15 or more via PayPal, I'll send you the new book plus the first book, The Octopus of Global Control, in digital formats only. If you want the paperback version, you're going to have to go to Amazon to get that. But it is now out and available. And thank you so much to our sponsors. C60 Purple Power has been with us now for the better part of this year. And I've been taking their products every single morning. I take a teaspoon of the avocado flavored C60 Purple Power liquid. And it's, it literally takes you 5 seconds. So it is the easiest thing that you can do to incorporate this into your daily routine. C60 is a naturally occurring molecule comprised of 60 carbon atoms that forms something that looks like a hollow soccer ball. It is a free radical sponge with the ability to neutralize free radicals and reset itself again and again. It is the most powerful antioxidant known. The guys that discovered it won the Nobel Prize, and they didn't even have to drone strike a bunch of kids at a wedding in order to win that. So everything about it is fantastic. I suggest you go to c60purplepower.com. Just read up on it. See if it's a good fit for you. If you like it on your way out, use the promo code MACRO to save yourself some money. They have free shipping inside the United States on anything over $99. And also, since we're talking about getting yourself ready for the apocalypse, I guess, consider going to preparewithmacroaggressions.com. Through that site, which is provided to us by My Patriot Supply, they've got discounts on four-week supplies of food and 3 month supplies of food. And considering the issues that we're already seeing with supply chain breakdowns, I think it's probably better to be a little early on this than a day late. So do yourself a favor and just start thinking about how you're going to get ready for what we see coming. And if you are so inclined, you can go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com. Well, a couple of months ago, I had the pleasure of being part of a group podcast where we talked about aliens, and I was so excited. And So I reached out to our guest to have him come on, see if he could fill us in on this. He is the author of Human Hybrids, The Forgotten Exodus, with the foreword written by one of our favorites, Graham Hancock, and also Exogenesis. But you might recognize his handsome face from the wildly popular show Ancient Aliens on History Channel. Of course, I'm talking about Bruce Fenton. Hey, Bruce, good to see you again. How you doing, buddy?
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm doing well. Strange times we're living in, and but apart from that, you know, coping more or less with all the madness. Yeah, you know, it's good to be on. Appreciate it.
Well, it's funny because you and I are reaching out. We're setting this up, this interview up via email. We get it all set up. I go to the gym. I'm on the treadmill machine. I look up. They've got History Channel on, and there you are. You're everywhere. I felt like it was kind of a sign, like, okay, this is meant to be.
I had someone say to me actually that they were in the hospital and that when their child was being born and I came on the TV. So I said, I always feel like I was there part of the birth. It's kind of weird. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, that show is fantastic because it's not just aliens, it's mysterious ideas and interesting places. Mm-hmm. And for people that don't get out much, you know, you can watch that show and feel like you've gone to Egypt or Machu Picchu, yeah, or all these unusual places. It's kind of like, mm-hmm, a History Channel. It's the History Channel and the Travel Channel kind of mixed together. I really like that show, but I'm into that stuff. You know, I'm into aliens. I'm into and I don't have any particular information about it. I just have, mm-hmm, an interest in it. So how did you get started in this? Like, what sort of a background? I'm just curious, what sort of a background do you need to be into this stuff and be able to write these really interesting books?
Yeah. I mean, I really got into the ancient mysteries and paranormal and fringe kind of subjects when I was about 11 or 12. And it was kind of strange. My grandmother used to buy tea leaves in these boxes of tea leaves, right? And they would often come with collectible cards. And these are like really small cards with information. So some of them was like flags of the world, right? Mm-hmm. You just have a sticker on a card. And there was one set that was, I think it was 40 different unexplained mysteries of the world. And so you had all the things like the Yeti, the pyramids, Loch Ness Monster, you know, all the classics were kind of covered. And I guess it just kind of grabbed me. Yeah, like, just really sort of amazed all these intriguing mysteries that were still unsolved, you know, especially that age when I suppose you think most stuff's been resolved in the world, you know, mm-hmm, as a kid. And it turns out that there's, you know, dozens and dozens of mysterious kinds of phenomena out there that nobody really understands. And from then on, yeah, I started to get more interested in particularly the paranormal and ancient mysteries initially. Mm-hmm. But did, you know, dovetail into the UFOs and aliens, you know, as you go on, as you know, a lot of these subjects, they interlink. So, yeah, you know, you can hardly sort of avoid ending up going down the rabbit hole of dozens of other topics once you start on any of these kind of mysterious phenomena subjects. But yeah, it got more serious from probably my early 20s onwards, you know, after uni kind of thing, that started to read a bit more in depth on these topics. And eventually, I suppose, had enough knowledge that some radio shows and stuff would invite me on. I suppose the last 20 years, I've been doing writing and speaking in these topics, primarily online radio. But yeah, it's been quite a journey. And to get to the aliens bit, which is the last few years, has taken, you know, a winding route through all kinds of strange phenomena. So it didn't start out as, you know, that I was fanatically interested in UFOs or aliens. It's just, right, it's really come out of other research.
Yeah. When I was 16, I went to Egypt with my mom on a trip. It was one of those things where it was like, she said, let's go do something interesting. Mm-hmm. Where do you want to go? Where's the place that you think would be the craziest place we could go? And I said, probably Egypt. Let's go. And I had an interest in the pyramids. I didn't have an extensive background in it. I was 16. But I knew I liked it. I knew I thought it was interesting. Yeah. But when you go there and when you stand there and go inside them, I don't know if you can, mm-hmm, still, but mm-hmm, I went inside and went in, mm-hmm, the chamber and it is, it, I mean, I've stood next to tall buildings before. I've been in big cities, but that wasn't the vibe. The vibe is you feel simultaneously like insignificant, mm-hmm, and small, and also part of like something magical. It really blew my mind, yeah, to see these things. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I have this. I've been to the pyramids. I've had the guided tour. I've been to the Natural History Museum in Cairo. I've gone to all these other places down. You know, I know what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. Well, then Robert Schock comes out, and then Graham Hancock come out, and then they start talking about water erosion and things like this on the Sphinx, and they start talking, they start having questions about the dates and things. And I go, maybe the science isn't settled, you know, to borrow a term that's been going around lately.
Yeah.
Did you ever get, did you get into the Egyptology? Was that a component that sort of jumped out at you? Because as far as mysteries of the world go, I mean, whoa, that's got to be right up there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I was fortunate enough to go to Egypt in 2011, November 2011. One of my friends who's a fairly prolific researcher of the Egyptian mysteries, Richard Gabriel, and he's got a book on Amazon if people look for it. But he happened to be out there at the same time. And because he's been going out there, you know, for years and years, he knew some of the more interesting sites that I probably wouldn't have got to otherwise. And so we ended up visiting, I'm trying to think what it's called now, there's not far from the main pyramids, there's a collection of kind of ruined smaller pyramids. Abu Ghurab, sorry, that's it, Abu Ghurab. You've got a kind of collapsed pyramid there with a really strange alabaster platform, the Hotep symbol on it, it's called. And that whole site you've got is mica flooring. It's all been kind of shattered. And then these strange urns. And I didn't know much about it at the time, but later on, after coming back from Egypt, there's a really interesting article by William Henry, the mythologist, where he talks about it being potentially a Stargate, that the legends are it's kind of a Stargate site. But it is a fantastic site. So if anyone can get access, I mean, you do have to, you know, make an arrangement with someone to see it.
Right?
And that's really one of the really cool sites that really intrigued me, because apparently that there is legends that it's one of the oldest sites on the plateau, and that maybe is built over, you know, some kind of lost civilization chamber type thing as well. But yeah, no, we also went out into the desert, and we went to some underground areas, into tunnels and stuff, you know, where you get a real sense of that perhaps this was some kind of survival bunker, almost the structure we went into, and down into these tunnels. And the guy was saying that there's shafts there that just drop so deep that you don't know, you know, no one knows what's at the bottom. You know, if you drop a burning piece of paper or something like that, you know, you can kind of see it light up, but it's so deep that you couldn't really go down to find what's there. And you just wonder, and you know, is there still some amazing remnants of that lost civilization down in some of these tunnels, you know, which from what I've heard, there are, you know, so the people tell me. But yeah, no, I've been interested in it, certainly in the Egyptian mystery and the lost civilizations and those kind of stories that they are the remnants of an older, you know, like an Atlantean type culture that, you know, is the rebirth of a older civilization. And that was always quite intriguing. And when you look at some of the cutting of the stones, and obviously you've seen this, you know, it looks like they had, you know, an amazing knowledge of stonework with technology and sort of advanced understanding of engineering that parallels ours, but doesn't necessarily mean it's using, you know, modern electrical equipment, you know, but they obviously had an understanding that was as good as using that. That's the way I look at that. It's like, although it's not clear what they did, you know, it's not just copper knives and stuff, right. You know, the stuff that we're sold.
Not just slave labor carrying things up, carrying rocks unusual distances and lifting them up, you know. I wonder, I mean, does anyone, what's the word on how these pyramids were built? We've heard of sound waves being used to levitate thing. Any insights on what we where we are in this process of trying to figure this out right now?
Well, I mean, I do think that some of these arguments to do with creating blocks from some kind of, you know, like a concrete or a mixture that then they solidify, that, you know, that's quite compelling, especially when you look at some of the stone that it does have inclusions and stuff that, you know, it makes you wonder if it was at some point a kind of a slurry, you know, that's been shaped into blocks. There's some evidence to suggest that in at least some cases that could be it. I mean, not so much with the granite and stuff, but with the large sandstone blocks and things that, you know, I think maybe more so. I've seen the theory that there was perhaps a spiral construction within the pyramid. And you see this, the imaging shows what looks like the remnants of a spiral. So maybe they worked their way up in this kind of spiral shape, which makes some sense too. But yeah, I don't know whether, you know, did it go all the way to some kind of sonic technology that, you know, lightens the blocks. I mean, it's possible. I mean, it's, again, then you're going into, is it technology? Is it consciousness and all that kind of side of, you know, whether or not we're talking about, you know, psychic powers. And I know for some people that's just goes into such a extraordinary set of claims But at the same time, you know, I wouldn't disregard that. I think it probably is a technological engineering solution, but you know, you just some of the stories, you know, that they've sent to us just makes you wonder with the, you know, tales of Egyptian magic and stuff that, you know, you do wonder if it wasn't a little bit more into the metaphysics, but yeah. The mystery remains.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the mystery, I'm really interested in this concept of exogenesis, right? You literally wrote the book on it. So what is, well, what's the, I've got the guy who can explain it better than anybody. What is exogenesis?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exogenesis is basically the same term as panspermia, more or less. Okay. The idea that, you know, our genesis is external to the earth. So exo being outside of, so we have this genesis that's beyond the earth, and panspermia, obviously, similar idea that we've come from out of space, at least our genetic origins lead to outer space. Now, the classical panspermia model is that either there was some kind of bacteria or virus, or, you know, single-celled life form that has drifted through the dust clouds and has ended up raining down onto the earth, taking root probably about 4.5 billion years ago, because that seems to be looking at both the DNA evidence for a last universal common ancestor, as well as fossil evidence. You know, there's an indication that life probably emerged around 4.5 billion years ago. And that in itself is poignant because the planet's about 4.6 billion years old. So if you think that in 100 million years, life appears, and that first period is really inhospitable. You've got the planet is, you know, magma, roiling, lightning storms, and asteroids are hitting us continually, pieces of protoplanets and stuff. Right. So that would have been a really hostile environment for that first 100 million years. And yet then life just suddenly appears. It's almost as though as soon as the, you know, the garden is ready, that seed germinates, as though something is already there or life has been deposited there at that moment, right? Rather than a long process of geology and chemistry giving way somehow to biology, which is usually inferred to require a very long time in the theoretical models, that we expect that to take a very long time. But this isn't a very long time. This is very suddenly emerging the moment it can. Now, I think that further strengthens the idea that we are looking at panspermia, just this kind of this quickness. And on top of that, we have this second version of panspermia that is a deliberate seeding, you know, that potentially an advanced civilization has fired out, you know, probes carrying life across the galaxy, seeding worlds, or, you know, maybe even little pellets, you know, containing DNA goo. And the reason I say that, because I talk about one of those in the book. And it can, of course, it can be a spaceship landing, you know, putting life on the planet. You know, it can. So there is that alternative view as well, that it can be directed panspermia. Yeah. Now, my view is probably that one, but you can't really distinguish them, you know, in the fossil record. You wouldn't really know. You would just say, well, life appears. Personally, I think if you compare panspermia to abiogenesis, panspermia has been increasingly accepted in the last few years because, you know, we found all the building blocks for life out there in the cosmos. We found them on, you know, asteroids and on dust grains. There's evidence of viruses that have been found also on the hull of the space station and rain down in the upper atmosphere that don't, you know, don't seem to be indigenous terrestrial viruses. So that case has been strengthening, and yet we have no further evidence of abiogenesis, and nothing new has come up to really support abiogenesis. The idea that life can just, you know, spontaneously emerge from, say, a rock pool because of whatever, lightning or whatever it is that happened, that never happens again. So we have 4.5 billion years ago, life appears, and no other life form that we know of on this planet is traces to an origin distinct from that. Right. So if life can emerge fairly quickly from geology and chemistry on Earth, why does it never happen again? And that's right. Been a conundrum for the abiogenesis kind of theorists, that you'd expect to see that happening again and again over the next 4.5 billion years. And so they're still looking for this kind of what they call the shadow biosphere, that the possibility that it's there somewhere in the soil or something. There may be some other life form, but we found no indication of it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So anyone who's sort of pondering those two, I think they'll find that, you know, panspermia is ever strengthening. And as well as that, because there's the complexity of DNA, the DNA molecule and the DNA code, which, yeah. I mean, the discoverers like Crick and Watson, when they were first detailing the DNA molecule, they did speculate as well that, you know, perhaps it was too complicated to have arisen so quickly. And again, at the time, we actually thought it was about 3.7 billion years ago. So we've actually gone even quicker now, that they thought it was so quick for something so complex to emerge, because you've got this that you need, not only do you need this code, which is itself super complicated, but the structure of the molecule is also super complex. So, and these two systems kind of have to arise spontaneously together to give us the DNA molecule and its code, right? And so the odds were just, you know, infinitesimally large that this would just happen. I mean, that's not to say it absolutely couldn't, but it's so improbable that they sort of theorized that maybe it was directed panspermia that gave rise to DNA.
That leads me into the movie Prometheus, which is fascinating in mm-hmm. that is directed panspermia and they bring in black goo. So first of all, I mean, I know that it's obviously a science fiction movie, but we also know that they like to hide things that they think are real in science fiction movies. So when I'm seeing this, I'm seeing black goo, I'm going, uh-oh, hang on a second. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I've heard mm-hmm. about that stuff. I think that maybe like the first time somebody hears about the concept of programmable black goo or just that, they go, that sounds ridiculous. Mm-hmm. What is it? And why should we actually pay attention to it?
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, actually, the black goo appears in X-Files with them.
Oh, does it? I never got into X-Files mm-hmm. for some reason. Mm-hmm. I probably should. It just sounds like it'd be right up my alley, but for whatever reason.
It's an alien black goo, yeah. And then when they touch it, you know, it sort of goes inside them and kind of reprograms them. It's like living black goo that's been left by the alien. So again, that theme repeats. And I know there's some researchers, you know, there's a researcher that's written about that he claims there was an event, some kind of asteroid or something impacted in the past and brought black goo to Earth, which brought, you know, this some sort of transition to humans as well. So again, it seems to be a recurring theme. So then now we're back to this modern kind of, I guess, conspiracy theory, or if you want to call it, that there's, you know, that potentially there's some kind of black goo being used now to maybe modify humans again. It is funny how these themes repeat, you know, both in science fiction, in independent fringe research, you know, and in perhaps in, you know, cutting edge technologies. We see these things repeating. It's kind of, I find it quite fascinating myself, you know.
Yeah. I'm curious. I've got this book called Who Built the Moon? By Alan Butler, and they make an interesting comment in there. They say, you know, it's 1/400th the size of the sun, and it's 1/400th the distance away. And it makes this, you know, it lines up perfectly. Statistical anomaly. It should rightly, the existence of the moon should rightly be explained as observational error.
Yeah.
So what? I mean, I read that and I was like, okay, hang on a second. So the moon's not there. Like that, I mean, that's what they said, the best case for it. Then you hear David Icke talking about Credo Mutwa and these legends of a time before the moon. And so I'm going, all right, what do we make of this? Do we even know what's going on with the moon?
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I mean, I have suspicions that potentially the entire solar system may have been cobbled together by some, you know, type 4 civilization. I mean, you look at some of the strange anomalies out there. I mean, everything from, you know, the hexagonal pole on Jupiter, and then you look at Iapetus, this strange reflective moon that seems to be welded around its equator with this giant wall. You know, and there's other kind of peculiar objects, you know, in our solar system, which, you know, the other one is Ceres. You have the dwarf planet Ceres, which, you know, they found, I wrote an article on this, but they found in the craters there, you've got this luminescent material, which is what they sort of spotted this light in this crater. And they said, you know, maybe it's very highly reflective. But where that is, you also find what looks like a engraved geometric pattern, which is like it's like this triangle, a square, and a circle kind of combined, which is really reminiscent of the alchemical squaring of the circle. You've got this strange kind of triangle and square and circle together, you know, kind of mixed together, which we have as an alchemical symbol, which again is really funny. So it's almost this was calling attention to that. So you've got it in a crater with luminous material, right?
Yeah.
And then you go deep into it and you find this strange geometric pattern. And that was picked up by artificial intelligence that was designed to find, you know, signs of intelligent built structures and stuff out in space. And was also then verified by a group of volunteers who didn't really know what they're looking at to see, do they see any geometry or structure in some pictures? And they also picked up on it. So I thought that was quite fascinating. So you think that the independent witnesses saw square, triangle, circle, and so did the AI. So I think that there are fingerprints across our solar system suggesting that there's been meddling. And we have to think that, you know, that the theorizing is that if you get to a sufficiently advanced level, that you could move planets around, possibly even move your star, right? I mean, it sounds mind-bending to us, but then, you know, there's, you know, that's the theory is, if you can get to those kind of, you know, higher levels of technology, that, yeah, that you could do all kinds of astonishing things. Now, could our moon be an example of that? You know, because there's evidence that it may be at least partly hollowed out. So it seems to be too big to be in its position with our planet. No other planet has got a moon comparatively the size of its planet. And also, you know, there's aspects to it, you know, that we can't figure out how it formed, you know, because it doesn't seem to mesh with either the single whack or double whack theories and stuff that they've thrown at it. So, you know, I do wonder if we're not looking at, you know, the fingerprints of someone who was here before. Now, whether that's advanced aliens or whether it was a technological civilization that existed on Earth, or it could be Earth or Mars, Venus, whatever, that someone perhaps in the solar system that had a technological civilization that rose to great prominence, did all kinds of amazing things, and has either left or faded away. And again, that's a possibility. So I would say when we look at aliens and the things that we would find, say, in our solar system, for aliens, we wouldn't be able to tell them apart from sort of crypto terrestrials or, you know, a neighboring civilization. You know, there's not really any way we could say, well, that's definitely not from, you know, within the solar system. It must be from Alpha Centauri or something. All we'd be able to say is that there's evidence of advanced engineering and stuff. Right? And I was sort of leaves you pondering sometimes when people say, you know, they've seen some of this evidence of extraterrestrials. It may be that there was someone here before us. And that's been, written about fairly recently in a couple of papers. There's, if you look for, there's one on, I don't know what it's called now, but they basically wanted to examine whether or not there was the possibility that a technological civilization could have existed on Earth, you know, and be lost in the fossil record. And the basic conclusion was yes, that you might be able to detect, if it was millions of years ago, you might be able to detect something like a strata with some evidence of them having done, you know, radioactive, you know, works or leaving some sort of radioactive traces, maybe something in the atmosphere that would persist, but that really you could have an entire advanced civilization on this planet that would just be disappeared completely. So, you know, science kind of aligns with these possibilities, which does make you wonder, yeah, that could someone have been here before and put the moon there? And certainly, much as it's like a big, crazy claim, you know, again, we have to be careful not comparing what we can do to the limits of what can be done.
Yeah, we get real caught up in the fact that, well, because we can't imagine it, that it couldn't possibly happen. Mm-hmm. I watched Farsight Institute a while ago, a couple of years ago, did an interesting remote viewing session on Iapetus, on this moon. And I don't know if you're familiar with their work, but they do the drawings on on the whiteboards, and they don't really know what they're looking at. And they're all drawing the same thing. And they drew this base on Iapetus that they said, well, this would be the prime, like the equivalent of like the scenic overlook of the Grand Canyon, where you park there and you get the best view of the Grand Canyon. They describe this as the best view of Saturn, probably the best view in the solar system that you could be in this place. And they describe this base as not being military and not being a military base, but being more like a gigantic resort type, like a vacation destination that advanced civilizations or people with, I don't know, I mean, to put it in our sort of weird context, people with a lot of money would go to this base, you know, and they'd have it'd be like the equivalent of going to Fiji for your honeymoon. Yeah. You know, you'd be like, let's go to Iapetus and have the view of Saturn and everything. Mm-hmm. So I'm watching this and, you know, and I'm trying to, it's going in my rational brain and it doesn't, my brain doesn't know what to make of this stuff. So what do you think? I mean, we've got Ingo Swann in the 70s, before the Voyager probes hit Jupiter. He's telling them there's a ring around Jupiter. And they're like, no, you mean Saturn. He's like, I know the difference between Saturn and Jupiter. Mm-hmm. And there's a ring around Jupiter. And sure enough, they get there. There's a ring around Jupiter. So where do we put remote viewing in this whole thing? I know it can be kind of hokey for some people. I know that, like, the normies will have a hard time wrapping their head around this, but I have come to learn, like, do not be dismissive of remote viewing, that there is something to it. What are your thoughts on remote viewing?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we've seen again and again that most people have some degree of remote viewing. And I went to, we did a training exercise in it at a conference I went to in Mexico years ago. And we had one of the guys from the original project Stargate. I'm trying to remember the guy's name now that made the reason he made the documentary, Third Eye Spies. Trying to think of his name, but anyway, he was there and he kind of did an exercise, you know, what's in the box, you know, people had to sort of see what's in this box, and you could write down, you know, what you know, if you've got lines, circles, and you said, you know, what you feel about it, is it hard, soft, you know, so you'd have different ways, obviously different people have different ways of doing this. So, you know, but some people, they might feel something soft, or, you know, they might feel a circle or whatever it is. And some people would see something, you know, and so everyone had to sort of go at this. And the funny thing is, because it was kind of a conference where you had, I guess, quite a few people that would be, you know, intuitives, professional intuitives in their work. And in fact, you know, the person who did the best actually was a chap who was an engineer and had come along because his partner is a sort of psychic and an intuitive, but he actually did the best, which I thought was quite funny because his partner, you know, might think would be the one to pick up on it being very psychic. But yeah, he actually drew the object, and it was this, it's like a sun wheel, you know, like a Vedic kind of sun wheel with a goddess statue. And so quite an abstract thing. And he actually drew this statue with the sun wheel and everything. So he totally saw the target, and he'd never done remote viewing before in his life. So
I'm sure the CIA was like, you come here, let's talk.
That's good. But so, I mean, it's one of the things that's been pointed out in the past is that it does seem to be that anyone can do this. I know the BBC, when they did a series with, I think it was Arthur C. Clarke or one of the sci-fi writers, you know, the famous sci-fi writers, that they did a series, and they used the BBC, one of the BBC team members, as the kind of, you know, as the kind of, I guess, the person who would have no experience of this, and kind of, you know, show that somebody that couldn't do it. And ironically, she ended up being able to do it better than the professional kind of remote viewer. And again, so it shows that it's something that is in basically everyone, like an untapped ability, and that it just is that we just wouldn't think about it or wouldn't try it, because if you haven't heard of it, and you may have episodes of it spontaneously in your life, but it really is, I believe, an ability that is linked to the fundamental nature of reality, that we are all interconnected, that everything is interconnected, that there is no space between me, the computer, you know, there's a seamless sea of energy, you know, that's just the simplest way to look at it. At the sort of quantum level, that there isn't any things, you know, we know that if you go down to that level, you can't distinguish the table from the air around it or from me, you know, there'll be no way to distinguish these as objects, right? So if the information is spread out in this ocean, right, if there is just consciousness, energy, really nothing else, you know, there's like no things really, then the mystery is, why don't we know everything all the time? The mystery isn't, why do we sometimes know things far away or know extraordinary things that we don't think we should know? It's actually the opposite. It's, why are we somehow filtering out knowing all things at once everywhere? Right. Because we are all things at once everywhere, right?
Yeah.
So I think when people sort of think about that, that's what fries your brain more, is the all knowing, and we're not. So somehow we're filtering out masses and masses of data down to just this experience of small I doing my things. And yet we can have these leaps where the barriers, if you like, or the filters go down a bit, and information from what we perceive as far away is in our minds, you know, in our consciousness. Right. So I think that these, you know, telepathy and other skills, again, now relate to this, that there's no particular reason why you shouldn't know the thoughts of what we perceive as other people, because again, that they're part of a continuum of you, the universe, and all the rest of it. So again, the mystery is all about why we feel so separate and so small.
Well, it's interesting, because when you get Bob Lazar on Rogan and they're talking about these spaceships and reverse engineering, and they're talking about no control panels or whatever, they're saying, look, part of what we have come to understand is that there is a component of the flying of these machines, mm-hmm. these UFOs or reverse engineered or whatever we want to talk about, mm-hmm. that requires consciousness as a component of that, that really threw them for a loop, because they're used to, like, you know, sticks and rudders and things like this. And they're trying to, you know, we're trying to use our logical brain and figure out how to fly this thing. What they're saying is, no, it's more than that. It has to do, you have to be on a different level. And so, would that not play right into this? That if we're talking about an advanced civilization, they would have a better understanding of the role of consciousness in something like controlling a spaceship, even?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, if you, for what they're worth, you know, if we look at the experiences that people have where they say they've interacted with beings or crafts, you know, and again, you know, some of these seem to be physical experiences, some seem to be otherworldly metaphysical experiences. But which again, hard to kind of completely detach the two based on what I've already talked about. But, you know, in these experiences, often the people say that the craft are alive and the craft seem to be watching them or telepathically communicating with them, or they touch the craft surface and feel that it feels like it somehow is, you know, aware of them. Now, I mean, that's a kind of a detail that gets kind of put to one side, but I think it's very telling, because again, if the beings, you know, are also telling them, look, you know, we fly these ships by just telepathy, as a, you know, it sounds more like that they are in communion with their craft, and that the craft also is conscious and aware, and it's reacting to their thoughts in the same way that they seem to be telepathically communicating with each other and with people they interact with. So, I mean, the other side of this may be that, yeah, that it doesn't need a control panel because the craft is alive. You know, they're just asking it, please, can you take me to Alpha Centauri? And to the craft, like, yeah, sure, I'll do that. So that may also be part of the story, is that, you know, it's really, they've gone beyond where you just have a craft that we think of as just, you know, the vehicle, but the craft is itself a sentient entity that is traversing time space. And that, I think, makes a lot of sense, particularly if we look at, say, our own technology, and we look at the, if you look at the direction where it's going with, say, AI and also bioengineering, and the idea of, like, singularity of merging biology and technology and stuff. Now, if that's happened out there in space, why shouldn't there be, you know, craft that are alive, that are, you know, either AI or are in some way biological, but, you know, a being that has gone down that route and has transmuted the standard form and flesh and is now part biological, part technological, and can do things that a normal biological entity couldn't do, like, you know, persisting in space, perhaps, you know, understanding how to warp the fields of space-time and all over the vast periods that they've learned this stuff. So, I think we have to rethink the idea of what the crafts are. And that's for people that look at those topics. I understand some people just be like, well, they're so wacky, there's no such thing as these crafts and all the rest of it. But, you know, even if we just take that as a theoretical kind of thought experiment, we're like, what would we expect of the technologies or the crafts of beings a million years from now? Do we really think it'd be just like how we have a hunk of metal that we put a booster on, we fly around? I mean, it doesn't really make sense, because, and again, I write about in the book a little bit that, you know, I talk about a craft which is a living AI. And I think that if you look at the cutting edge of space science and what the theorists are talking about, they expect aliens to have essentially living AI craft. And again, this is coming out from the mainstream as well, that if you look at it, why would you waste all that space on a hull and all this stuff which doesn't do anything, if you could have the entire structure being, say, silica, you know, to process, you know, information. You can have this entire living AI ship, you know, made of largely of silica or another, you know, similar compound that would allow for computation. So you could have your entire craft is the computer, rather than a little computer on a what is basically a wasteful craft. Like, no space goes to waste if the whole ship is alive and is the computer, right? So this is the kind of thinking that we do have in the cutting edge, but most people in the public don't really look at that information, right? So they think that sounds wacky or new age, but no, that's that's where we are kind of looking at going, is to have living ships that are just, you know, big chunks of kind of silica AI and stuff flying around. So why wouldn't we expect something like that out there?
Yeah. And I heard an interview with Jordy Rose, the former CEO of D-Wave talking about supercomputers and their quantum computers that they were making. And he kind of casually talked about, what we do is we open up another dimension and then drag information back. And I thought, I don't understand how that works. I'm going to trust that Jordy Rose understands how that works, since he's, I don't know what his designation is, engineer, obviously, of some sort. But that sounds really dangerous to me to open up parallel dimensions and drag information back. Is that where you think we could be getting some of this information? Because it seems like maybe in our dimension we're limited, but in other dimensions maybe there's some other properties or some other rules that don't necessarily follow the rules that we're used to in our dimension. Is that like the people that are working on real advanced space technology, are they incorporating things like quantum computers into their usage in order to find information?
Well, I mean, just look at the story of Jack Parsons or something. I mean, the occult and the metaphysical world has always been linked to the space program and to man's quest for the stars. I mean, the two things are so intertwined, from astrology to astronomy, and from the aliens to consciousness. These topics, they are interchangeable in a way, because if you look at who's very interested, who's involved in the space program, you've got a lot of Masons in there, a lot of Masonic occultists. You've got those who inherited the wisdom or knowledge of the Nazi occultists and stuff. Yeah. And you've got the magicians that were, the Crowleyite magicians and stuff that were in there. And I'm sure there's some other very normal, geeky scientists, but there's definitely a lot of peculiar people that went into the space programs, really. I mean, Parsons is there designing pentagram rocket boosters that took us into space and stuff. You hear accounts of stuff like, supposedly, places within the intelligence community where there are, experiences, people who had metaphysical experiences who are being kind of mined, people who work in the intelligence community, not like, kidnapped, but who are also sharing their experiences to inform what's out there, this space program and what entities are out there. Because there's obviously, just as there are people in the general public who say they've had interactions with beings and all sorts of strange experiences, so too there are in the military and in the intelligence community and in the government. These are phenomena that happen to humans seemingly at random, and so they apparently have tapped into some of these people. I've also heard of that there's a room somewhere with, people from the intelligence community, on DMT going into these other realms and getting information from beings and bringing it back to advise on technological breakthroughs that, people going and seeing the mantis beings or whatever, and the mantis beings are there saying, hey, we've been expecting you, here's the diagram of this booster you need to make, and, take this back with you and remember this, and that would sound especially so bonkers. But then to anyone who, explores like through DMT and ayahuasca and peyote, it doesn't seem so bonkers. And then on top of that, you have people like, if anyone's read, American Cosmic, there's a description in the book about, a person who's well positioned to do with the space program and towards futuristic sort of engineering projects. And he says he has, communion with some conscious force that's in a room, and I think it's at a NASA building, where there's a room which exudes this consciousness of something alien. So he doesn't know what's in that room necessarily, but there's a special room, and outside of it he could feel this consciousness communicating with him, and it would give him designs for things that he was making medical technologies that were breakthrough technologies, which he has said he sold for millions on, they're on the stock markets and stuff. And so there's, which to a lot of people just think, it's just crazy, but there's people like making millions of dollars selling stuff that's inspired by their interactions with the phenomena associated with aliens, space, UFOs, contact and all this. So there's people literally using that to inform, say, the space program and our technological breakthroughs. I mean, that, most people just sound so mad, but then if you think, well, throughout history, we have accounts of people who received information that was useful. I mean, there's an Indian mathematician who came up with these formulas. He said a goddess was giving them to him. They checked the formulas. Formulas are all sound. They're still using them in maths today. And, we've had other people who said they've dreamt solutions to problems, all the rest of it. I mean, so this has been going on a long time. The idea of the muse and, you know, people being inspired by the other, and that these giving us useful breakthroughs. So I definitely, you know, I'm of the mind that it makes sense that some of that is happening. You know, it's quite possible that some of the stories are made up, but I think that, you know, some of that will be happening. Like, I don't know, if you look at these like MK Ultra, some of the experiments that have been done in the past, I think we would be naive to think that nobody would have tried this, right? Looking at the crazy experiments that do definitely happen and have happened, the idea that nobody has thought, let's try the DMT and see if we can make contact with something out there which could give us technologies. I mean, I would be shocked if it hadn't happened.
Of course. I mean, I've done DMT and begged aliens to come interact with me. You know what I mean? If I'm looking for it and I'm just some dude, then no doubt the intelligence agencies are doing it. And you and I did a group show a couple of months ago where we talked about To the Stars Academy and that they have 100 years of CIA experience sitting on their board of directors, and how we're not taking anything they say as the gospel in this. But who do you think really is in charge of disclosure? Not this fake TPSA horseshit, but like who's running the show? Is it NASA? Is it the CIA? Is it some agent? Is it, you know, some majestic agency that nobody really knows about? Like, who do you think has their goods on this?
Yeah, well, I suppose, I mean, again, there's some level of what is disclosure to different people, first of all, because, you know, I guess some people would be satisfied if, let's say, a president went on TV and said, we actually kind of had an ex-president gone to TV and say UFOs are real. And we've had the Obama thing recently with, UFOs are real. But then other presidents in the past have said UFOs are real. So, I mean, I guess what we would almost have for a lot of people, they want the president to say aliens are real. I suppose if we had something like that for a great many people, that might be disclosure. You know, we've got a president's come on TV, says aliens are real, even without any particular proofs. But then for other people, you know, they want something like a rolling out of a craft and bodies and documents. So I think it's a bit relative in terms of what disclosure is. And again, if there's so many people woven into this intelligence community and into the military industrial complex that would know different things and different projects, that, you know, it'd be impossible to know if you knew everything, you know. So without the total collapse of secrecy, you would never know that you had all the goods, right? Because some other project may know something else. I think it's such a quagmire that there can be no such thing as disclosure other than the removal of government and removal of the intelligence community to be, you know, gone. Just if that was all gone and there was a public access to everything that existed and all of their projects, then that would be disclosure, right? Anything short of that, we would still be, have to assume we are being lied to. Who controls all of that? I think if we were to go to the higher levels of this, you know, and obviously this is my opinion, I think that we are dealing with people who, at the very least, they believe that they are in contact with something other. That, you know, when you get to the higher levels of some of these very strange kinds of projects, now that doesn't mean all intelligence people or military people would be in those circles, but that those people who are concerned with this stuff, that they believe they have got contact with some other intelligence. And if that being real, that would put that intelligence at the top, because if they're looking up to him and they believe that they have made contact with something that has special knowledge, advanced technologies and all the rest of it, then that would then by default become in control. Because once you become dependent on the technologies or know-how of somebody else, they're technically your boss now, aren't they? If you're reliant on them, then you've already been kind of annexed into their program. So no matter how those people look at it, I would say that, you know, it's almost like a bit of a poison chalice that they've probably drunk if they have indeed made this contact, because really that's a good way to kind of was to annex a planet, is to make it reliant on you and your technologies. Now, whether that's physical beings or some kind of interdimensional intelligence or something like that. But, you know, there's enough subjective kind of anecdotal evidence out there suggesting that these, certainly that there's people in the higher levels that are involved in ritual magic and occult practices, and they go into the Bohemian Grove and they go into this stuff and they're dressing up in their robes and they believe that there are these ancient gods. You know, I've spoken to experiences, you've interacted with people that are quite senior in some of these projects who say, you know, you've got to believe in the devil and go to Bohemian Grove. And all. So, I mean, look, there's a lot of very strange people in those, the high levels of those projects, and they believe that they are in contact with some kind of higher intelligence, some kind of gods. Obviously, there's a lot of conspiracy around the idea of sacrificing people to these gods, all sorts of other stuff. You know, look, historically, you know, some humans have always felt that there are beings that you should be sacrificing people to and all the rest of that. So there's a long unbroken tradition of belief in a higher intelligence you can commune with that wants something from us, but will give something for you, like in a sort of Faustian bargain. And that seems continued. And no matter how extraordinary and mind-bending that sounds to some people, that could even be possible, you know, only to look at our history of unbroken belief in that idea to at least believe that some people take it very seriously, even to today, and that some of those people are in very high positions. So their belief will have an effect on you, whether you agree that it's actually a real thing or whether you think they're just delusional. They're still believing it and they're still changing your world.
Yeah, that's I've mentioned that many times before. It almost doesn't matter what I think or what you think. Mm-hmm. To them, it's important. And so therefore they act as if, and so you have to kind of, it might be easy for us to be dismissive of it, but they take it seriously. So I'm watching them and watching, you know, their behavior. One of the things I think this is maybe if accepting aliens are all around, you know, have been visiting us for years and years is a bridge too far for some people. I think there is at least one small step towards that a lot of people can get on board with. And that is the concept of reverse engineering technology that has been left by them. Do you think, so we're in this world now where we have, I don't know, tens of thousands of sightings of triangular craft. Mm-hmm. I think we've rightly identified those as TR-3Bs, not extraterrestrial in nature necessarily, but maybe their origins are. What's the role of reverse engineering technology in this? Is this baby steps to alien technology? We're sort of like slowly walking ourselves to it. Is that real? I got a quote from Ben Rich in my first book talking about, you know, we have the technology to take ET home and it won't take a lifetime. And you know, how does all this stuff work? And he asked Jan Harzen, you know, you tell me, how do you understand how ESP works? He goes, I don't know, all points in space and time are connected. And he goes, that's how it works. So, so they're clearly reverse engineering something. Is that fair to say? Is that a real thing?
Yeah, I have sort of kind of conflicting opinions on that topic. So I think that let's just say, you know, an alien spaceship, super bizarre, advanced alien spaceship crashes on the planet, right? So you send in your teams, you know, whatever, maybe you could move it. But even then, from that moment onwards, you're in a predicament, because what if even moving the thing makes it explode and destroy your whole planet? I mean, what part of your reverse engineering can be considered safe if you have no idea what you're dealing with, right? Yeah. So like anything you touch in there can be the self-destruct, right? Anything you touch could be the energy modules or the control. You literally would go in totally blind in the way that a caveman would go in blind to reverse engineering an iPhone, right? They wouldn't know what the material was. They wouldn't know what it did. They wouldn't know anything. The only thing you would understand is it once flew, you know, if it flew, it moved. We don't know if it vectated or if it teleported. You just have this crashed thing, right? So I think the danger in that, and I think any scientist who'd sit down and were asked by the military, well, they would see the danger in this. So, you know, we want you to start pulling this apart. Whoa, you know,
yeah.
What? You know, what if I touch the wrong thing and it just melts us all, you know? So I don't know. And again, if these things really are, as some people have explained, you know, solid state, you know, with no real obvious controls as well. I mean, what even informs you as to how to reverse engineer? Because if there's no obvious controls and it's linked by telepathy, like, where do you start? So, I mean, some of these narratives conflict, because we have the story of the reverse engineering, but then we have all these accounts of these ships that have no control surfaces and stuff, right? And they've got no exhaust, nothing we recognize from a plane or a spaceship as we understand them. So I think maybe you could get as far as taking a sample and starting to understand the materials that it's made from, right? But I don't know that you could go any further than that without an intelligence informing you what to do. And I think that's, again, when you get back to, you know, are we seeing some kind of contact? between people in the military industrial complex and another intelligence, and maybe some kind of, you know, a gift or even a poison chalice gift, perhaps, but something that has been left here either by an intelligence or we have acquired something. And then an intelligence that's already in contact has helped with that process and said, yeah, we understand this. You know, you just do this, you take that. I can't see without help that we could get anywhere with it. Again, you're back to, like they say, the iPhone and the caveman. I really think how would he even start, you know? And even if we move the iPhone into, say, the Roman Empire, right? Like, how far would the Romans have got with it? I don't think that they could have got anywhere. You know, there's such a gap between a species that could traverse the universe and, you know, end up here, assuming that's what it is, and a craft that is controlled with their minds and stuff to our current science, that I'm really sort of at the point where I'd struggle to believe that we could do it without help. And so if we have done any reverse engineering, then again, I think that in itself would prove that we're in contact with somebody that understands the ships, because otherwise I just can't see it. You know, would you want to be the first, you know, the scientist, they say, chip that bit off over there. What is it? I don't know.
No,
could be anything.
No. But I think about that movie Contact, how they then were given instructions and they had to wrap it around a cube, and then it made a little bit more sense. And it was sort of like, okay, if you can figure this out, you're intelligent enough to kind of move on with this. I just wondered if there's blueprints embedded somewhere, but like you said, the idea that maybe something is guiding you through the process, it's something communicating with you, saying, don't touch that red wire. Definitely don't touch the red wire. Yeah. That'll blow everything up. But you know, you want to do this or you want to touch. So I have these, just curious of how that whole thing might even work.
Well, you'd want to, if I had one, you know, if I'd captured a craft, you know, and I was a evil government, all government's evil anyway, but so if we're in an evil government, I don't know what to do with it, but the best thing I could do with it is leak the story that I've got it and I've reverse engineered it. I mean that in itself is a massive step forward, isn't it? Because if all my rival governments now believe that, you know, not only if I've got a craft, but I'm reverse engineering it and I've made technologies from it, perhaps new planes, even design some planes and drones that look super weird, and say that, you know, leak that they're running on anti-gravity and that they've got super weapons on them. I mean, it could play an amazing role in a military fog of war without you ever doing anything with it other than it sitting in a bunker with you scared to touch it, you know, because in some ways that would be enough to frighten every other government on the planet, wouldn't it? The fact that they understand you have an alien technology and by all reports, you've been reverse engineering it, right? I think that in itself would probably stop any enemy attacking you forever, right? Because would they want to find out if you've really got, you know, cosmic blasters on all of your weird drones that you've sent out? Do they really want to find out the hard way? So I don't know that you'd even have to touch the thing to become, you know, the top player. Just to let people know you had it, I think would be sufficient.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap up with this one. Since you had Graham on writing the foreword to your book, he makes an interesting He talks about this concept. He describes this as being a species with amnesia. Do you think that's accurate? That somewhere along the way we have been redesigned or configured to forget like the way you wake up in the morning and you've got a dream that's like self-destructing right in your hands. You can barely remember it and then it's gone. Do you think that's been embedded into us so that we can't remember who we really are?
Yeah, I do think there's something that's happened, like some kind of collective trauma or something that is blocking out our, not only our sort of our understanding of who we are and where we come from, but also of our gifts of the spirit, if you like, you know, all of these powers like the, you know, the telepathy and the remote viewing, that I think they probably at some point were widely known, widely understood. You know, to me, they're clearly functions of being a human being, right? So I think at some point they were widely known, widely understood, and that something has happened that has derailed that and then has been further played on by the powers that be, if you like, to keep suppressing certain knowledge. But I think there has to be a destabilizing event or something at some point for someone to then suppress that. The knowledge had to have been in some way destabilized. Now, also, I wonder if it's not to do with some kind of blocking of DNA. You know, that I think the information, you know, is retained in our DNA from our vents. You know, we know that our ancestry, you know, we have information from ancestors in our DNA. We know that through sort of epigenetics and stuff now that, you know, experiences are passed on. Also that DNA is this unbelievable store for information. You know, we're designing DNA storage plants now where they're going to, you know, record all the knowledge of the world into DNA, which you can put into a fairly big warehouse, you know, which is kind of crazy, but you can also grow memory. And I've sort of heard talking about like growing a kind of organism, almost like this, like a giant brain or something of DNA. If you think it's kind of horrific sounding, but that you'd have almost like a living memory bank made of DNA. Some really weird stuff I've heard of that they're doing, or at least looking to do. And that, you know, is there information about who we are and stuff locked in our DNA? Now, if there's DNA gives out photons of light, you know, biophotons, right? We know that biophotons move around in the brain between the microtubules. And I tend to think that maybe memory is stored in those light photons, right? In the biophotons of the DNA, so that your brain is really accessing light, and it's accessing light from DNA, and that is somewhere recorded in your DNA, those events that knocked us for six and made us forget this stuff. And also is the story of our ancestry and how we were, in my view, created, engineered by an intelligence. Also, I write about in the book, Connected Genesis, that I suspect that information is in there too. And so sometimes when you hear about people saying, oh, I have this strong feeling that, you know, I'm from somewhere else and that, you know, I believe that I lived in the Pleiades or, you know, I've come here and all that. I just wonder if, you know, some of that isn't that they've tapped into something in their DNA rather than they've had some particular experience, but it feels to them like, you know, it feels like I'm from outer space and it feels like I've been made by someone else. And that I just wonder if that's not a story that is encoded, you know, literally encoded into our DNA, that if in the right, maybe meditative state, that you can start to do the reading of that light information from the DNA and get the whole story. Now, which I would think would be a story that parallels in a lot of detail what I've written about in Exogenesis Hybrid Humans, you know, the idea that that we have been created, you know, well, at least modified by a visiting intelligence 788,000 years ago is the most accurate dating on some of the material evidence involved. But I suspect that story, yeah, may well be encoded into our DNA. So could it be that we are a species of amnesia who maybe is about to find a way to restore that information from the, you know, the hard drive backup, you know, somewhere in our system, that we all do know this stuff already. And, you know, you get that in a lot of the mystical traditions, the idea that we know everything already, that you don't really need to be taught from outside, that it's actually that we're just not accessing what we already know. And I tend to think that that may be very literally the case, and that there may be a physical component with DNA involved in that story.
Oh, it's so fascinating to me. I just find, I don't expect to have all the answers, but I certainly am interested in looking for them. Bruce, I'm going to put all the links to your books on Amazon in the description, but where is the best place for people to connect with you?
Usually on Twitter. I mean, they can find me as Exogenesis HH. I mean, as we're talking now, I mean, I'm currently on a ban because of my opinions, but I'll be back again until they chuck me off. But other than that, yeah, I mean, also I have a website, brucerfenton.com. They can find me at, and the books we say are on Amazon. They can email me if they have something, you know, pressing to ask, which is Bruce@brucefenton.info as well, or find me on Facebook, you know, to get a message to me.
Yeah. Oh, I love your stuff. It's great. That's Bruce Fenton, everybody. Go out and support his work. Buy his books. They'll blow your mind. If you're interested in connecting with me, you can do so through the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, and take the additional step right now of sharing this podcast with your friends and family. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Bruce, for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.